guys, and welcome to episode 186 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now, in this episode, I interview therapist Shmuel Fischler. Shmuel is an OCD therapist based in Baltimore, and specifically in this episode, we talk about religious OCD and scrupulosity. So this is part of my theme series where I'm going into the different themes of OCD, trying to cover as many as I can. And we talk about what is religious OCD, what is scrupulosity, what's the difference between the two terms, common compulsions and obsessions within this theme, distinguishing between what is a religious ritual versus what is an OCD ritual or compulsion, working with religious figures to support therapy, example exposures for religious OCD, the effectiveness of ERP for it, family involvement, and then words of hope and much, much more. So I enjoyed this chat, and thank you to Shmuel for his time. And without further ado, here he is. On the podcast today, I'm joined by Shmuel Fischler. Shmuel is the owner and lead clinician at CBT Baltimore. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you on. And I was on your web show a while back now, so I'll link in the show notes to that if people want to check it out. So it's nice to be able to return the favor. So before we start, it'd be good just to hear your therapy story. What got you into being a therapist and also treating people with OCD?
Sure. So when I first started getting into the field, so I worked in an adolescent clinic, and it was fairly general, whatever sort of came through the door, and it was a great experience to be able to get all that experience. And then I always wanted to expand and get more specific training in different areas. And I have a relative who primarily treats OCD. He still does. You might have met him at the conference, Meshulam Epstein. And he sort of turned me on and said, hey, why don't you, you know, try this out? And I had originally gone to the 4-day intensive with Edna Foa over at University of Pennsylvania. That was a great experience. And then from then, what happened is that in the clinic, so now I was just identified as, you know, the OCD guy. So ultimately, anything that came in that was along that spectrum of OC-related disorders that came to me. And then I started going to the conferences, and then I kept on pursuing more training and more training. And I work with a lot of things in the whole OC spectrum disorders. So OCD and panic and social anxiety and BFRBs, a little bit of hoarding, sort of that extended family, all those cousins. But I particularly really enjoy working with people who struggle with OCD. I think they're super creative. I think they're very intelligent, and they're quite motivated to really work on it. And as we know, and the treatment for it has got really good empirically based, you know, evidence behind it. So it's really nice, you know, to work within that framework.
Yeah. No, thank you for going into that. It's interesting. Yeah, and I can imagine once you get trained in something, then the other people in your clinic will be like, you're good at this. Here's more people with OCD.
Right. Yeah. Whether you are or not.
Well, yeah, that's true.
I'll just say that. No, I've been fortunate enough to be able to get lots of experience and then pursue supervision on it and continue to do so and go to the conferences, which have, you know, just been phenomenal.
Yeah.
To develop more and more.
Cool. No, thank you. Cool. So got you on because I know you have a liking for religious OCD or scrupulosity specifically. So it'd be great to kind of go into that in more detail. But I think first of all, it'd be defining what is religious OCD and scrupulosity, and also is there a difference in those terms?
Right, great question. And I think it's a little bit, for those a little bit less familiar, it can be a little bit misleading in that saying that it's, you know, scrupulosity is a subtype of OCD that presents itself in the arena of either morals or scruples, hence the name, being scrupulous about something, being right, wrong, heaven, hell, God, religious practice, spirituality. But the reason why I say it's a bit, it can be misleading is that it doesn't necessarily have to do with religion. So when I'm doing an assessment with someone and we're sort of going through the Y box, which is the assessment tool for OCD, and we're getting up to the section, which, by the way, this won't come as I think a surprise to any clinician out there, research out there, you know, with all due respect to the Y box, I think most of us will agree it could use some beefing up or enhancement. And I think particularly in this area of scrupulosity, because there's so much nuance in different cultures and different religions, I think we could do, we can improve on something that's already good as far as the assessment tools for it. But that's a side point. So it can be a little misleading because it can certainly do present itself with someone who's an atheist, who's agnostic, who doesn't affiliate with any religion or any culture, but it's still someone having to abide by quote unquote rules and rituals in the arena of morals, of being right and wrong and doing the right thing and doing wrong, and what are the ramifications of that. But yes, certainly it does and can present itself in the religious practice arena, although I'm sure we'll get to that later, it really has nothing to do with religion.
Absolutely, yeah. Cool, no, thank you for explaining that. And what are some of I'll let you kind of describe it as you go, whether you're talking about religious OCD or scrupulosity or kind of merging the two together. So what are some of the common compulsions and obsessions one would find?
Okay, so let's focus first on the religious OCD, where it does present itself within religious practice. So it's going to be, I think it's important for clinicians out there to, this is where a good dose of cultural competence comes into play, because with every culture and with every religion, there's so many nuances that I can't say that I'm an expert in all cultures and their traditions. So it really is important, even just to be able to assess, is to be curious about the religious practice and be willing to collaborate with people of the faith in that culture. So that being said, it's conceptually similar as it is in other forms of OCD is that someone is doing something, whether it's inside their head, so a mental ritual or a behavior, in order to reduce the anxiety or the discomfort that comes along with the thoughts that are being intrusive as far as, are they doing the religious practice enough? So, for example, if someone is praying. So the maybe thoughts or the what if thoughts that we're all familiar with is, well, what if I'm not having the right intention? Or what if I'm saying it wrong? What if I'm not saying it clearly enough? What if I'm not enunciating enough? What if I'm having a negative thought while I am saying this prayer? Now, does that mean that now that I had, so for example, I had a young girl who I was working with who, while she was saying her daily prayers, a thought popped in, like the word fat popped in. So now to her, okay, that popped in, or the image of someone fat to her as a young girl popped in. Okay, so now does that mean that I'm going to be fat and God wants me to be fat because I had that thought while I was praying? So now, okay, now I got to say the whole thing again. So she was repeating and sort of redoing the prayer so to neutralize the power of that intrusive thought. So it might be repeating multiple different types of religious practices. So it could be praying, it could be confession, it could be studying, it could be All sorts of different religious practices. I mean, I coming from the Jewish religion and a number of people that come to my practice come from the Orthodox community. There's different religious practices that will come up again. We'll say it again and again. This has nothing to really do with religion itself. There's been studies done, research done. Religion, I'll just say this very, very clearly for everybody, religion does not cause OCD. So if you're on the fence about being religious or not, and you're thinking, well, I don't know, religion may cause OCD, it doesn't cause OCD. Now, it might be a good breeding ground for someone who's already susceptible to that and vulnerable to that. It might be an opportunity, but it certainly doesn't cause it. So there are religious practices. So let's say for a religious Jewish person who keeps kosher, for example, it's certain dietary laws. For Muslims, it might be
halal.
Halal, thank you. So it gets pretty detailed as far as the parameters of that. And then the doubts can come in, well, maybe this is not kosher, maybe this is not halal, or maybe this touched that. Now, so there could be checking. So checking to make sure that everything's okay, and then checking with their spiritual guide or spiritual leader, whether it's an imam or a rabbi or a priest, whoever it is, checking. And this is where it can get a little bit tricky, because on one hand they're the guide, but on the other hand it could easily fall into them being used as part of their rituals of checking and reassurance and things like that.
Cool.
So those are some examples that come to mind.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. That was useful. So my next question was kind of there. You kind of alluded to it there, but in a lot of religions, there are some religious rituals that could be deemed compulsive in nature, in the sense of Hinduism, there's a particular prayer that's recited like 108 times with beads, which is, even by someone with OCD standards, very compulsive. But obviously it's naturally part of the religion, right? And it's a nice thing in their eyes. So how do you sometimes, when you have OCD that's attaching to a religion, how do you sometimes differ between this is actually what's in my religion versus this is an OCD thing?
Right. Great question. Very fair question. And it's you can assess it fairly easily. People with OCD can assess this on their own. Mm-hmm. Is that, what is my feeling attached to this behavior? So if the thought is a thought that I don't want to have, and then I'm doing something, and the objective of me doing that something is to provide relief and get away from feeling uncomfortable or anxious, then that falls under the OCD. If it's something that I enjoy, so, you know, who, you know, an ethical clinician, I think, is, it's not their job to tell someone that they have a problem. You know, it's not my job to judge like what their practice is or what their culture, religious practice or beliefs are. That's completely inappropriate. So if someone has, let's say you gave the example of someone who's Hindu and has the prayer. So if you have a prayer that's 100, 200 times, and it brings joy and meaning and pleasure to you, go for it. Mm-hmm. I mean, do it. So what kind of feeling does it give you? If it's, I'm just consistently trying to avoid this discomfort and get away from this yucky feeling, for lack of a better word, then that's not being driven by something that I want. Is that being driven by a value that I have, something that I enjoy, something that I want, something that I'm pursuing? The other way, I think, is, and it could be that Dr. Grayson has put this out somewhere. I mean, he's put out a lot of the stuff that we know out there, but it's asking yourself very simply, would someone, maybe this is like a form of the gun test that he talks about, would somebody without OCD do this? So if I'm about to say this prayer again for the eighth time, very quickly, gun to your head, would someone without OCD do this? And 10 out of 10 times, a person's able to really say, you know what, no. Someone without OCD is not going to say it for the eighth time, because I'm really just saying this just to make myself feel better about something that I don't really need to do. Yeah. So those, I think, are the like sort of like two strategies in order to assess that difference.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, good points. And I guess it can be tough, because when OCD is latched onto religion, and you, for example, if I stop praying because... Or changing prayers because of OCD, I'm then losing out on a key value of mine, which is my religion, my spirituality. So yeah, I guess being able to decide when it is religion versus when is it OCD can keep that meaningful part of their life intact, so to speak, a bit better.
Right. So if I can say something on that, I think you really hit on just like a really important point on what makes maybe scrupulosity or religiously based OCD unique from maybe other OCDs is exactly that. At least in my experience, it becomes really the hardest or the most challenging part of the work is for someone to really accept that this is not part of my religious value. And it for some, if they can't get to that point, they feel as if I am, or whoever's working with them, is like ripping their value away from them. You're asking me to go ahead and do something that's completely against my strong, important religious beliefs. And how in the world could you're asking me to basically, like, you know, put a gun in my mouth, you know, God forbid. You know, that's how visceral sometimes the reaction is, because there's a very... in a way, it's similar to, in general, how when we're working with people who have even anxiety and OCD and other things, just in general, the relationship we have with our thoughts. And if our relationship with our thoughts is that, well, if I think it has tremendous value, I can't let go of it. And you know, the metaphor I give sometimes, which is helpful to some people, is that if you and I were by a lake and we were throwing pebbles in, throwing rocks in, and so we're skipping pebbles and we're having a nice time, and then you pick up a pebble and say, "Hey, Shmuel, this is not a pebble. Look what I found. I found a little gold nugget." And I'm like, "Stuart, man." I love you, man, but it looks like it's just a pebble. And then you say, no, it's gold. You put it in your pocket. A couple minutes later, we're skipping rocks. Another one. Look, I thought this must be an old, like, gold rush mine or something. And you put it in your pocket. Keeps on going every couple minutes till, you know, by the time we're done, your pants are falling down because your pockets are full of gold nuggets. And to me, they are pebbles. They're rocks. And that is, you know, in simple terms, is the difference between someone who has OCD and someone who doesn't, is the value that they're placing on those thoughts that we have. So if I think it's gold, then yeah, who in their right mind would throw a piece of gold back into the lake? I'm going to go keep it. So especially something as meaningful and close to a person's heart as religion, which is for most people, it's purpose. It's purpose in life. And if they believe that there's a next world, then we're talking about not just purpose in this world, purpose in the next world.
Yeah.
That's a lot. So if we rush through the beginning stages of trying to separate thought from reality, or thought from what I need to do, and understanding that just because I think something that has to do with my religion doesn't make it part of the religion, if we rush through that, then we're gonna have a hard time, because it's gonna feel like they are gonna feel like as if you're asking them to transgress something that's really important to them. And if we can get to the point where, hey, this has nothing to do with religion, you are a devout religious person, and you want to take the same amount of risk that every other devout religious person of your faith would take. So if you're a Muslim, so another devout Muslim, you know, they are also taking a risk in not knowing if their prayer is exactly the way they should be, or if they're doing exactly what God wants them to do. Mm. So you want to take the same amount of risk. It's not religion, it's OCD.
Yeah. Yeah, good point. Thank you for that. And I like the metaphor. Okay, so next question is, well, when you've been working with someone with religious OCD or scrupulosity, have you ever got like the priest, the imam, or rabbi involved?
Right. I think it's really important, but doing it with eyes wide open. Mm. So I will refer a little bit to, I said, my relative, Meshulam Epstein, who sees like sees religious OCD from like morning till night, all day, every day. And I've learned a lot from him. It's very important to collaborate with whoever the religious figure is. Mm. And sometimes that religious figure is actually somebody in the family. It might be a grandfather or something like that, who's sort of like the figure, the paternal, you know, religious figure in the family. Is definitely to collaborate with them and to give some psychoeducation if they don't already know. B is to talk about the reassurance piece, the accommodation piece. Mm. And finding a way to give them what they need, but not get sucked into that reassurance. So I'm thinking of a particular client, a woman who was asking her rabbi questions multiple times a day. So over the course of a month, it was maybe 50, 60, 70 quote-unquote religious questions to the rabbi. And he was a very patient man. but ultimately, you know, everyone sort of has some limit, and at certain points he was getting fed up. Mm. So we worked together on trying to understand like what the function of you answering these questions are. So it might be putting a cap on questions, or it might be him having everybody, including the client and the religious figure, preparing and saying, this is the type of answer you're going to get. It's almost like a canned answer of, you know, well, maybe you're going to have to guess. And so there's an exposure in the sense of, if I have a religious question I want to ask my rabbi, and I've already asked, I already filled my quota of, you know, 20 questions for the month, then I have to guess, would another devout religious Jew ask this question to the rabbi? I have to just guess. And that itself is an exposure. It's almost like a double exposure, because I'm guessing, that's an exposure, and then I'm not asking, perhaps, because I decided that another devout religious person wouldn't be asking that question. So it's certainly collaborating with them, but it's being mindful that that religious leader can really get that this is not religion-driven. And being able to know what family accommodation is, or we'll call this rabbi accommodation or whatever it is, you know, and be able to hold back. It's hard to resist, because a spiritual leader is that inherently is their helpers. And if someone comes to them, they want to help them. They want to guide them. They want to, you know, give them what they want. And it's hard to resist that. So it's involving them, but not turning them into accommodation.
Yeah. No, thank you. Yeah, that was useful. So you mentioned an exposure there. I know that the listeners often like it when people detail exposures, because it kind of brings it to life. And obviously it's also going to depend on, you know, what each individual client's worries are around their various gods or religions or rituals. But yeah, any kind of any kind of examples you have on exposures you've done for people with religious OCD or scrupulosity would be great.
Sure. So a couple come to mind. So one is, let's say this a client who a lot of the theme of the obsessions were around keeping kosher in the kitchen, lots of different rules. So one particular law in the Jewish religion is that you can't consume blood. So someone who's Orthodox and or not just Orthodox, so someone who keeps kosher, you'll see that the meats and the chickens, they're salted extensively, so in order to pull out blood, because it's one of the things you can't consume blood. Someone who checks eggs before they scramble their eggs, they'll actually look to see if there's a blood spot and a blood spot in the eggs, because you can't consume blood. Okay, so for her, the doubt was is that maybe I want to put a slice of pizza in the toaster oven. Maybe, you know, I think I might have gotten a cut a couple days ago, and maybe it didn't heal completely. And what's going to happen is that when I put the piece of pizza in the toaster oven, it's going to transfer over, and then it's going to get into the food, and then I'm going to eat it, and then I'm going to be transgressing this prohibition of consuming blood. Mind you, I couldn't even see any cuts. Mind you, there were Band-Aids on top of the unseen cuts, and, you know, the chances of something transferring is, you know, zero to none. So the exposure for her was to, and because of this, she avoided eating a lot of food. I mean, it was terrible. It was really unfortunate. So the goal was very simple: have a slice of pizza. it was taking your bare hands, taking a piece of pizza, and ideally, we all want fresh pizza, but we're talking about frozen pizza here. You take the piece of pizza and you put it in the toaster oven, handle it with your bare hands, put it in, and take full bites and chew it, and, you know, with the risk that maybe I am consuming blood. That's one example. I had another interesting, very interesting. These are interesting, but it's also very unfortunate. I really felt for the guy because he really, really struggled. The thoughts for him, the intrusive thoughts were, maybe I am serving idols, idol worship. So in his religion, it was, you know, he served one god, and then to serve other gods or other idols would be one of, like, the biggest transgressions you could possibly do. So for him, he collected precious metals, like randomly silver, gold, and he had them in his house. So the thought for him was, maybe without intentionally, I'm turning that into an idol. I'm turning that into a god, because technically you can do anything. This even happened with his wife's wedding ring. Imagine that. His wife's wedding ring, when she took it off at night and put it in on her nightstand. Maybe now I turn that into a god, an idol, and now every time I, like, move or bend over, I am bowing down to that idol. So I'm worshiping something that's not my god. When I wash my hands in the morning, then one of the ways that someone is able to serve a god is by virtue of pouring. So when I'm washing my hands in the morning, maybe it's like a house of cards. Not only maybe did I turn it into an idol, into a god, but now maybe when I'm washing my hands, with not me really wanting to, my intention is to serve that god by pouring this water here. So the exposure was to do exactly that. Exposure was to wash his hands. Exposure was to actually carry around his wife's wedding ring at night. Like, when she took it off, is to specifically not avoid it, but to go pick it up and carry it around, with the risk that maybe I am worshiping idols, which is like a big no-no. Some people, and this is where the imaginals come in. So Matt, for just quickly, it's just for those who are not familiar, when we're doing the exposure work in ERP, so there's really two different types of exposures, as I'm sure most people know, that you're doing the in vivo exposures, where you're able to engage in something that brings on the uncertainty, and you're actually doing something. You're behaving in a certain way in order to bring on the uncertainty. But then there's ones that are imaginal, where we're trying to create the imagery or the scene environment of that uncertainty, because it's really hard to create that in real life. So this is something we haven't touched on yet. So if someone is doubting, well, maybe I am not doing what God wants me to do, right? And maybe I'm missing out on my whole purpose. And maybe God is really, really ticked off at me because I am not doing what he wants me to do. Now, the truth is, and I recently had a client like this, and the truth is, you take the most religious, spiritual, pious person in the world, you know what? They don't really know either. Nobody really knows if they're doing exactly what their God religion says that they're supposed to. No one really knows. Yeah. What they do know is they know enough. They know enough. So when it comes to something that's more abstract, such as going to hell or God being ticked off, then we have to be, I think, a little more creative on creating an imaginal exposure of what that looks like and writing out a story or narrative of what that looks like, what happens. Let's follow that path of, you know, God being pissed and what does hell look like and all that. And then sit with that again, you know, again and again, and learn from that, you know, I can sit with that possibility. And let's clarify something. None of us want anyone to be okay with transgressing something in their religion. None of us want anyone to be okay with going to hell, whatever that looks like. I mean, that would be, you know, sadism. We don't want to be okay with the outcome, but what we want to be okay with is the possibility of that outcome. Because you know what? We all have to sit with that possibility of that outcome.
Yeah.
So when we do these things again and again, we're trying to help them learn that either that, you know, bad thing is not going to happen, or I could really handle it a lot better than I think I can.
Yeah, really good point. Good distinction. Yeah, thank you for that. And in terms of anyone that may wonder, is ERP as effective for religious OCD as it is for any other theme, like contamination, relationship, harm, etc.? Is that fair to say?
I believe so. The one caveat is like we said before, is that I think a clinician or someone who's going for treatment, you know, for this type of OCD, I think the foundation is maybe even more important, of that distinction between our thoughts and understanding that this is not religion. I think that's where, you know, I wish I can say that it's been successful for everyone I've seen with this type of OCD. It has not been. Mm-hmm. I think all the principles apply the same, and I think it can and has been very successful. But at the same time, it's that foundation of really getting that this is not religion. This is OCD. This is anxiety, and separating from the thoughts from me. I think that is integral to the success of the treatment. So the answer is yes, but making sure that you have that foundation and that psychoeducation. And that is the one of the parts of ERP that is restructuring, cognitive restructuring. Generally in ERP, there's very little of that. That is the one part that I think is cognitive restructuring, is how you approach thoughts in general.
Okay, cool. No, thank you for that. And you touched on families earlier, but I thought it might be worth going into a bit more, because from my view, a lot of religion is a family affair. It's often, if the person has it, believes in religion, follows a religion.
It's contagious.
Yeah, exactly. Often they probably got that from their parents or their grandparents or their cousins or whatever, and it kind of disseminates down through the generations. Probably more often than it's one random person's decided to follow Christianity and their parents are atheists, for example.
Right.
Although that does seem to happen more. So I guess my question is, yeah, I can see then the family both being a positive factor for treatment and potentially a negative factor too, in the sense of if they can't necessarily see that it's OCD and may see that some of the taboo thoughts this person is having could be quite sinful, or if that makes sense.
Right. Okay. So very good question. So let's look at both sides of it. Let's look at the negative and then the positive. So the negative is that while we said that religion doesn't cause OCD, I've had families where from a young age, possibly due to the parent having OCD as well, and then they include their children as part of rituals and part of OCD. One particular client is coming to mind where the father was, you know, he owned it that, you know, he has OCD, and from a young age he really, really pushed this repetitive behavior in religious practice and prayer and rituals from a very, very young age on his son. And so, yeah, it makes a whole ton of sense that the son was like really uptight about doing things again and again and wanting them to do them, quote unquote, perfectly or till it feels just right. So it certainly can contribute to a child becoming anxious and uptight about, you know, their relationship with their religion. So that's the negative side. And I guess adding to that is that let's say this father never was able to acknowledge that he had OCD, and then when his son got older and perhaps had, you know, different thoughts or different values, you know, how uptight is he going to be about his son's religious practice, and how supportive is he going to be able to be when, you know, he's having doubts and the parents are saying, no, just do it right and do it again. On the flip side, you can have parents who are super religious, but also super accepting and understanding. I have had some really sweet, understanding, very, very religious families sit in the office, and while they are very strictly religious, but they're very, very accepting of their child, understanding that this is a thought, and just having that permission, like, oh, really? It's like, it's okay to have this thought. You know, for some people who are religious, you know, and this is a part that I find tricky, is just the power of thoughts in general within religious arenas. So according to your religion, what is the power of a thought, which might be contrary to the clinically how we approach things? Well, a thought is just a thought. But hey, in my religion, if you think something blasphemous, that's bad.
Yeah.
I'm doing something wrong by thinking something blasphemous. So that could be challenging to reconcile. Now, if you have family, if you have parents that are supportive and say, you know what, it's very typical to have a negative thought, a blasphemous thought. It's and they give, not necessarily for reassurance, and not saying again and again and again, but they can be supportive and normalize that it's okay to have a thought that's not congruent to, you know, to your religious practice. That doesn't mean that it's not a value to you. It doesn't mean that you're not religious. It doesn't mean you don't have a relationship with God. It doesn't mean you don't care about it. It doesn't mean any of that. So having family who could do that, that's amazing. And then family who can understand conceptually the mechanics of OCD and then not fall into the accommodation or helping them check or helping them do things again and again and again, then that can go a really, really long way in helping them out.
Yeah.
So it could be quite positive too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Cool. No, thank you for that. So I guess general question, let's say, you know, it's the OCD conference in a couple of days. Someone comes up to you, says they have religious OCD, or they think they do. What would you say to that person?
I guess I would. Good question. Is it in middle of a session at the conference? Is it in between sessions?
You're in the foyer loitering around.
I would say, okay, so I guess my first, I would I always start from a place of curiosity. I think that's for me, that's like the best place to start. I would simply ask, what makes you think that you have that? If there's, you know, one thing that I've learned is that I can't make any assumptions about anything. Even if someone comes in and says very clearly, you know, I know I have OCD. We start from ground level up, and we're just curious and we're trying to understand. So what makes you think that you have it? And is it a problem for you? Because very unclinically, most people that I work with at some point, I'll say to them, you know, a problem isn't a problem until it becomes a problem. Right? That's my most clinical. It's only a problem until it's a problem for you. Right? So what makes you think that you have this, and why do you want to do something about it? That's where I would start. And then I would probably go into, so what's your previous experience in trying to address this? Have you been in treatment before? What have you done? What has helped? What has not helped? Things like that.
Yeah.
Without doing a full assessment in the hallway of the conference.
Cool. No, thank you for that. And then just words of hope for people experiencing scrupulosity or religious OCD.
There's, you know, if anyone is listening that is struggling with this, first things first is that I promise you that there are millions of people that are struggling with something so, so similar. Unfortunately, for a lot of people, they are sitting on their own, sort of stuck in their heads, and feel like they have to keep these quote unquote rules for themselves. Probably the most common adjective that I hear from people describing it is that it's exhausting. It is utterly, utterly exhausting. And to know that there are hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people who are struggling with something very similar, you think that your thoughts are the most off the wall, batty, weird thoughts. I promise you that that you would be blown away by some of the other thoughts out there. And I would really encourage you, try to find, there's so much now with technology, with a podcast like this, where you get to hear from other people and social media. There are so many people out there that you can connect with. There's, at one point, you know, I hope to restart it at some point. At one point, I had a very particular group for Jewish Orthodox men with OCD for that exact purpose, so that they don't feel like they are the only ones. Trying to connect with other people who have it, trying to find a provider that has the experience and the training. There is lots of hope, and I'm confident that with the right help, you can certainly improve your life. And I will just add that when you're approaching work, the therapy work, is really try to look at it as lots of gray and not black and white as far as progress. One thing that I've noticed in working with people, that it can get disheartening for people when the way they're defining and conceptualizing progress is like the thoughts are gone. Well, it may never be that they're gone. They might turn into background noise, but they won't be gone. Or my goal is to get to this point where I'm not doing any of this. And so now if I look at it black and all or nothing, then until I get there, it's like a failure. Really try to look at it as in gradients and degrees of progress, and then track it. I try really hard with the clients to track their progress so that you can look in the rearview mirror and say, hey, you know what? Just a couple weeks ago, you cannot do X, Y, and Z. And now it's like it's nothing. That is progress. So don't allow yourself to acknowledge progress, even if you're not at your destination. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's great. I completely agree on tracking. I think the brain has a great way of lying to you into believing that you've made no progress, when in reality, if you documented everything, you'd be like astonished at how far you'd come, even if it feels like you haven't at that moment.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll pull out a There's lots of good tools out there. I just made my own little tracking sheet that I use with clients. Sometimes we'll pull out one from, you know, a month or two ago and say, hey, look, see what you couldn't see, what was like, you know, way high up and on the hierarchy, and you couldn't do it, and you thought it was impossible to do this, and now you're doing this, now you're way past that, like, and they're like, you know, oh wow, yeah, you're right, yeah. You know, because people tend to focus on what they're not doing rather than what they are doing.
Exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. Cool. So, change of questions now. You pick up the phone and call your 20-year-old self. What would you tell him?
Ooh. I know exactly. Well, not exactly, but it's a great question. I think what I would tell my 20-year-old self was, allow it, not only allow, but embrace mistakes. Enjoy or appreciate every step along the journey of growing, of learning. You don't have to be at the destination. Not only is making mistakes or setbacks or not being quote unquote successful, not only is that unavoidable, that's inherently how we learn. So I would tell my 20-year-old self is to be present, and I tend to now more than always, but now even more than ever, I love sports. And I tend to incorporate a lot of, you know, either terminology or examples or metaphors from sports. I think it's very, very rich in being able to explain things, and people can relate to it if they're into it. And just yesterday, I was talking to a client, and if there's one maybe common thread throughout athletics and sports, is that it's a game of adjustments. Almost every single sport, whether it's, you know, water polo to golf to American football to football to really to anything, it's about making an adjustment. So I missed the shot. Okay, so the defense is playing this way. So their offense is playing this way. So now I need to adapt. Now I need to change. Now I need to learn from it. If I just focus on what I messed up on, or what I missed, or what I should have or could have or didn't do, then that's where I'm stuck. If I approach it that these are all opportunities. So in the same way, you know, there's parallels here. In the same way that when we're working with clients, and every time there's a chance to embrace an uncertainty, that's an opportunity. That's a learning opportunity. So the same parallel, I guess, if I can go back to my 20-year-old self and really encourage myself that those setbacks or those mistakes or those times in a session where it really blew up in your face, and or you felt like you didn't know what in the world you were doing, that not only is that inevitable, but that is exactly how you grow and how you learn, and you should look at them as opportunities.
Yeah, absolutely. And what came to me as you were talking there was this image of like manure, you know, where you, and obviously that it stinks, it's horrible, but it's how we grow stuff, you know. Exactly. And a setback is kind of like that. It stinks, it's not nice, but it's rich in nutrients, and that's what's going to grow. As cliche as that is, that kind of popped up.
No, that's a great example.
Yeah, I like the sport one, and it's sports also. It's about small, minuscule incremental gains, and I think in a lot of other areas of life, we don't look at it. We try and get ahead so quickly, and sport shows us that at the pro level, at least, inch by inch, that's what they're looking for, those tiny, and that's the difference between a championship team, and hence the Toronto Raptors this year, versus. Right. The Lakers, who didn't even make the playoffs, you know?
Right. And I use it. I mean, one day I want to put out something that has to do a lot with sports, because I think there's just so much there. Yeah, you're right. Took a look at the early career players versus the veterans and what they've learned and how they've been able to keep things in context, not too high, not too low, and then sort of slowly progress. One of the examples that I can give is, so I grew up in Chicago and I was a tremendous Chicago Bulls fan. So I was spoiled, tremendously spoiled, because we had Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen, and we won. You know, it wasn't a question of if, it was a question of how. Now, I remember seeing like a statistic a long time ago. You know, everyone knows how many games Jordan has won or how many crazy shots or game-winning shots. But at the same time, and this is not just with Jordan, but with any superstar, how many game-winning shots has he missed? Tons. Tons, thousands. It's like a crazy number. It's a crazy number of how much games he's lost. And that was completely on his head, his responsibility. Now, did he then, you know, give up from it? No. It was actually, he was known for how much practice he did after games. And games are over, he would sit and shoot like hundreds of free throws and hundreds of three-pointers and things like that. It was fuel. Mm. It was fuel. All these things were fuel for them to just, you know, get better.
Yeah, absolutely. It's perfect for ELP. Okay, so you've got a billboard in Baltimore. What do you want written on that billboard?
So what my dream is, you know, my dream is for CBT Baltimore to be a couple of facets. It's everything that has to do with CBT. I mean, we do a big bulk of, you know, the anxiety spectrum disorders, but also some trauma and depression and things like that. And we want people to really know what CBT is. Mm. So there's the clinical piece. We're building up a piece of CBT Baltimore that I know the letters are going to have to be really small on this billboard, the amount that I'm speaking, but there's the clinical piece, and we want people to know what it is, the regular person to know what CBT is, and it's definitely ERP and OCD work. We're building up the online platform to be able to just bring content to the public about mental health, about specifically about OCD and anxiety. But even more than that, I'm trying to build this local resources collaborative between not just, you know, people, regular people and us, but also other medical professionals. So you have doctors, you have nutritionists, you have people go to see so many different professionals in their life, and we should really be able to collaborate on a local level, even if it's virtual, to be able to learn from one another. And so if we help educate, you know, the PT or the nutritionist or whoever it is, or the primary care physician, and they know about it, then we're helping them. And then if I learn from them, you know, they're helping me. So we're really trying to create that platform. We're trying to build up the professional development platform through CBT Baltimore. We're building out our space, and we're going to have a great space to be able to provide those workshops. And so we want to bring like good professional development to clinicians out here, and in all the different areas of this spectrum of disorders. We want it to be accessible to other clinicians who, you know, I get calls from people I know, other clinicians who want to know more about it, and they just haven't had the opportunity to really, maybe they can't go to, you know, to Texas to go to a conference, or they can't necessarily go to a BTTI. So let's give them something. Let's give them the resources. So there's the professional development, there's creating that collaborative online, and then there's the clinical piece. And there's no question that another piece that I'm working on building is the groups. I think there's a really, really powerful, and I know you can attest to this, I know you've run the camps, right? Is I think it's a really, really powerful tool. I want to be able to build up the groups from, you know, something like a goals group or OCD and remission group, or we more recently have become part of something called the National Social Anxiety Center. We're affiliated of that, and a group for social anxiety. I just think there's power in in knowing that there's other people in my community who have that, like I mentioned, that the you know, especially with scrupulosity, that there's other people who are also really care about religion that also struggle with this. It's really, really that client we were talking about before, who was obsessing about serving idols.
Yeah.
So it wasn't easy. We didn't necessarily progress as much as we hoped to. But I'll tell you, we actually stopped individual treatment. And he chose to stop individual treatment. And then we started up the group, and he came to the group. And you know what? There were exposures that he was not doing individually, but being part of the group, he started doing them. Mm-hmm. It was so powerful. Just having his contemporaries, and, you know, at the end of each group, we, you know, made a goal for the week of trying to do certain exposures. And there was an accountability, and not coming from me. It was just coming from his peers, and he was doing some of this stuff. It was amazing to see. Like, he individually, it just wasn't happening in certain parts. And then he started doing it. So it's really powerful. It's not always so easy to build up groups and maintain groups, but it's certainly something that's on my wish list to try to build. So I know that's a really long billboard, but I guess that would be the billboard.
Cool.
That I hope.
No, thank you. It was great to hear your vision. And yeah, I agree with groups. I think they're great for many people. Thank you so much for your time today. I enjoyed talking about religious OCD and hearing your answers.
Yeah, I again, thank you for everything that you do and creating content that's accessible to people. I think it's really, really invaluable. And I'm grateful and honored to just maybe play a small part in it. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it too.
So there you have it. Hope you found our conversation useful. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It's not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. Until we speak, take care.